I signed for United in 1968. So they won the European Cup in the May. I signed apprentice. I started my apprenticeship on July the 27th, I think it was, of 1968. So I walk into the Cliff training ground, which we've been to, and I'm walking into those three superstars. Best, Lord Charlton, and Sir Matt Busby's the manager.
Welcome to a new episode of Talent Takes Practice, a podcast looking at what it takes to make it to the top of your chosen field and how we can use this experience to help youngsters maximise their talents, whatever those talents may be. I'm the co-host, Matthew Side. Alongside me, as ever, the one and only Roberto Savage, who, I mean, I know many of you will know this now, but somebody who's got very involved in youth coaching and somebody who I think has the makings of a fine football manager in the very near future. Although, Rob, I can see from your face, you're laughing at this, but you could do that, couldn't you?
Yeah, listen, it's one thing I dream of doing. But talent takes practice. You know, the amount of hours I practice to enhance my talent. You know, a little bit of talent with complete hard work, it just goes to show, Matthew, anything is of possibility. And that's why I'm so engrossed in this podcast. That's why I want to help so many youngsters. And what a fantastic guest we've got today, Matthew.
Yeah, and I tell you, I'm really excited about this because I'd obviously heard of Tony Whelan, a legend in youth football, somebody who's worked at Manchester United, knows everything about the culture of one of the greatest clubs in the world, somebody who played as a professional, I think I'm right in saying, Tony, for Manchester City, and who we've just discovered during the discussion before starting to air this podcast, wrote a master's degree dissertation on the Busby Babes. So we're going to get into that. We're going to get onto the stuff you were talking about, Robbie, about mindset, how to develop young talent, all of these crucial themes. And it doesn't matter if it's a football talent, a musical talent, an educational talent. I think the patterns are all the same. But let's bring Tony in. Wonderful to have you with us today, Tony.
Thank you, Matthew. Really feel honoured and privileged to be a part of your podcast today.
Well, look, I'm glad
fair,
you said
to be fair, Matthew. Matthew, trying to get Tony was like trying to get one of the royal family. Wow, dear.
It's taken weeks.
Yeah, he's won a couple of awards. He's like, you can't get him now.
To be honest with you, I'm not used to this sort of form of communicating, so it's not really my forte. But for Robbie, anything, of course.
I'll tell you, it was funny on the WhatsApp with Robbie. He said, look, we're going to get this. We're going to get Tony Whelan. And then a day later, it's like, can he do it? We're not sure. We have to go through his people. We'll have to talk to my people. We have to get the lawyers involved.
No, I don't think so.
The reason I wanted Tony on, Matthew, was because there's so many podcasts out there at the minute with the same, you know, fantastic people on. But I just wanted to give the people listening to our podcast an insight from somebody that may not be as recognisable or as famous as those people. But the insight Tony can offer with your knowledge, Matthew, can be invaluable.
Tony, this is why Robbie's such a good podcaster. The fluency is just, it's peerless.
But with your invaluable knowledge as well, Matthew.
It's Robbie being Robbie.
I think this could be a magnificent podcast for youngsters all over the world to listen to.
Well, look, joking aside, Roy, I really appreciate you bringing Tony into this because what you say, I think, is absolutely on the money. Because Tony, can we start by just talking about your coaching pedigree? You know, give the listener who may not necessarily have heard of you, I know everyone within football knows exactly who you are, but for those not familiar with football, just talk about how you started as a coach under Brian Kidd at United and Alex Ferguson, how long you've been there and what sort of roles you've undertaken.
Well, my coaching started before I came to United as a coach in 1990. My coaching started in the USA where I was a player. I played for the Fort Lauderdale Strikers. I was in Atlanta, the Atlanta Chiefs. I played in Philadelphia. I had a season on loan from Rochdale at the Los Angeles Skyhawks. But my coaching started there because as part of the contracts that you signed in those days, it was mandatory to coach young people or to do what they call coaching clinics. And I got involved in that quite intensively when I was in Fort Lauderdale. I was there for about 3 years and we did soccer camps and all the sorts of courses, recreational courses. So I sort of cut my teeth doing that, getting involved with young players at a recreational level, not thinking ever about elite elite football or coaching elite soccer players. And I just found it was really enjoyable. I connected really well with the young people. And I had an inkling that if I ever finished playing, when I finished playing football, I didn't quite know what I wanted to do. But I knew instinctively that I wanted to work with young players or young people. And subsequently, after I finished playing, I served my time as a social worker. I was a social worker in Manchester, working for the City Council for 15 years, for 14 years, as a residential social worker and a field social worker, primarily in education. It was at that point that I returned to the club because Brian Kidd was then working in the Centre of Excellence, which was a sort of a pre-academy programme, and with Nobby Styles, and they needed a bit of support. And I'd played with Brian in America. And Brian had actually been a part of some of the clinics that I'd done in Fort Lauderdale, so he may have remembered me from those days. And he invited me to join the staff for part-time in 1990. And I was part-time for about 8 years. Mm. And then the academy system was introduced in 1998. And that's when the whole profile of, you know, player development in the UK went to another level.
Yeah.
And they needed more staff and so on and so forth. I happened to be on hand. And I was invited in to be an assistant academy manager or a deputy assistant academy manager to my former colleague, Paul McGuinness, who's now working for the FA. So I'd been there 8 years before I went full time. And of course, since then, I've been head of academy coaching, and now I'm now academy advisor. So I've worked in a number of different roles with a range of coaches and obviously other professionals.
Now we're taking a break to tell you about this. Matthew, this might be something for you. I'm always telling you to look after yourself and groom proper. Manscaped is forever changing the grooming game with their Weed Whacker. Its intelligently controlled design enhances the trimming experience, and it's waterproof, which makes for an easy operation and cleaning. The only nose hair trimmer on the market with a powerful and rechargeable lithium-ion battery that lasts for up to 90 minutes of use. Look, fellas, 79% of partners polled admitted that long nose hair is a major turnoff. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code TALENT at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com and use code TALENT. What are you waiting for? Go whack your weeds.
You were at Manchester United, I mean, during an incredible era. The at Sir Alex Ferguson, the class of 92 in particular is interesting, given that that was the reincarnation in some way of the Busby Babes. What were your thoughts and recollections from probably the most extraordinary youth development programme that any club has had since Busby himself?
Well, I was, of course, part-time, and I used to come in at night, mainly Tuesdays and Thursdays, and those guys used to come in on a Thursday night, would you believe? They train at the Cliff, the training ground, the famous, the sacred yep. Cliff back in Salford, which was established in the 50s and even before that. And they came in with Eric Harrison and trained at a training session, 6 o'clock at night after being at college, I think, all day. So I got a taste of it, and there was a wonderful spirit about those lads. That's what I remember. And they were really, there was a wonderful camaraderie and spirit about them. And of course, you know, unbelievable talent. And you just knew that there was going to be some of those players were going to have wonderful careers. Maybe we weren't expecting them to have such a fabulous careers that they had, but you just knew that there was immense talent there in that particular group. And they were so together. That's what I remember about them. They were so together. There was this togetherness and this friendship that rubbed up on everybody else. You felt good just to be around them, the way they used to come in.
Tony, you know when you say you just knew, because in your illustrious career, you've seen thousands upon thousands of kids. But when you say you just knew, what was it in particular was that you seen in some of those, or nearly all that class 92, you thought you knew?
Love of the game.
Really?
Love of football, just a love of the game. Loving just being around, playing it, trying things out, experimenting, enjoying training, not seeing it as work, basically. Not seeing it as work, seeing it as a pleasure, I mean.
But you say that, John, listen, but so I'm sure Matthew, Matthew was a successful Olympic table tennis player, but there'd be hundreds and hundreds of thousands of kids around the world who love the game. But they didn't have what Beckham Scholes had.
I think if you've got talent and you've got all over the game together, it's not a bad mix, is it? Because you want to play, you want to practice. It makes you want to practice. It makes you want to work hard at what you're good at. It makes you want to sustain what you're good at. But the things that you're not good at, it will help you to want to improve because you just love the game so much. You want to get better. I think in that sense, the love of the game drives it. And I think it's one of the major responsibilities of a coach to make sure that light that was lit, you know, wherever a young player first fell in love with the game. If you think about it, you ever think about when you first fell in love with the game? I remember when I first fell in love with the game, it was a guy called Jimmy Greaves on a grainy black and white television in 1963, playing in the cup final, just drifting, gliding across the grass. It was like, what? It was amazing.
It's interesting this, because of course Robbie was there, this is how you know each other, at the cliff during the period of the class of 92. And by the way, for those who don't know what the cliff is, this is the United training ground that people Best and Charlton and Law trained on, and that they trained on until they moved out to the one, what's it called? Where is it? Carrington, is it called? The new one?
The Aeon Training Centre.
That's right.
Or complex.
Yeah, which is obviously state of the art. The cliff, I've been there and I've looked through the whole place. It was much more rudimentary, much more basic, but it kind of, it was a living history. You could almost smell the history when you were there.
I think it embodies the spirit of the football club, because so much of the history is still there. I think that's one of the things, when we have young players come to the cliff, we think it's important that they know who played there. We won the treble from there. You know, a lot of people don't realise that when we won the treble, we won it from the cliff. So you've got all the players, if you can imagine, the first team, the reserves in those days, the A team, all the professionals, all the young professionals, plus the football in the community, plus the Zen Centre of Excellence, all on that site.
Robbie, what are your recollections? Sorry to interrupt, Tony, but Robbie, I can see you're intrigued by this, but you were there too. What are your recollections of Tony, of the interaction with Eric Harrison, who of course was the head youth coach at that time, in Ferguson? How would you bring it to life for somebody who wasn't there?
So you'd go into the cliff in Lower Broughton. You know, the red gates, they'd open. You'd see the history. You'd see the stand on the far side, which is now just like a shack. Yeah. The surface was immaculate. We had Little Wembley behind it, Tone, didn't we, where we would go and practice in the afternoons. The gym was an old-fashioned gym. You know, it was just an incredible. The biggest thing for me was the glass window where Fergie's office was. And on a weekend, Eric Harrison, and Tony will talk about Eric, his mentality, his work ethic, you know, what he got out of us. And if you'd done something wrong, that window would be banging and you would look up and you were thinking, oh no. He'd walk down. It would take about 25, 30 seconds, wouldn't it, Tony, to walk down and be inside the pitch. Were thinking, oh no. But we could take it. Yeah. We could take it because we wanted to learn. Yeah, yeah. We were a group together. And, you know, we had to accept that sometimes you weren't good enough. And we were told off. We were shouted at. But that he wanted to make us better, as did Tony, as did Nobby Styles, as did Brian Kidd. You know, and it was just an unbelievable place to go to. The camaraderie, as Tony's alluded to. Now you see initiation ceremony when people stand on a chair and sing in front of the first team. You know, what we had to go through, was quite incredible. Do you know what I mean? And it was just, it would make you a tougher person.
I mean, talking about communication as well, because it was so tight, Matthew, the site at the cliff was so tight that it wasn't very far to go to see anybody. It wasn't far for anybody to give you a rollicking, by the way. But on the other hand, people, you knew where the physio was, you knew where the doctor was, you knew where the manager's office was, the coaches were quite close. So it was so intimate. It was so intimate. And so that aided communication. There's no question about that. I mean, communication, the methods of communication now have changed a lot, as we know. But in those days, it was mainly oral, wasn't it, Robbie? Mainly oral communication. And, people, everything being handed down by tradition, a certain way of doing things, a certain way of behaving, setting standards of behaviour. And that was passed on. I remember when I was, as far back as 1968, when I first joined the club as an apprentice professional, you had to knock on the first team players' doors to go in, to get their kit, to go and wash it and things like that. And you had to wear your club blazer for the matches, and particularly when you're playing in the Youth Cup. If you're playing in the Youth Cup, that was like playing in the World Cup final. It was such a big tradition for the club. So you learnt, you know, wonderful standards of behaviour, and also life skills, because you got, you know, you were given jobs to do.
Yeah.
You know, you had to, you know, clean the kit, you know, collect it, go to Old Trafford, do all the odd jobs, lay the kit out on the match day on a Friday. Get a telling off from Jack Crompton, God rest his soul, if he didn't lay it properly, and so on and so forth. So in terms of life skills, it, you know, for me, thinking back, looking back and reflecting, it was a wonderful experience for me. Amazing.
And you sort of asked a slightly technical question. I'll be interested to hear your view, Robbie. You talked about love of the game. Now, kids, you go to any field and watch or street and watch kids playing football, they're not playing because they're not getting paid. They're out there because they love the game, and their minds are alive to what football means, the passion of it, the intensity, the passing, and all the rest of it. At some point, for young people, once they show that they have talent, they end up in an academy, then an agent wants to start being associated with them because they want to monetize that career, then they have a contract and they have bonuses, and suddenly I think for some people, it'd be interesting to hear your view, Tony, their relationship with the game changes. I think Rory McIlroy in golf, I mean, he's even talked about this, that he used to play golf for the love of the game, and then he became a brand. You know, he was a Nike ambassador. He was there to sell golf clubs, and it changed his relationship with the sport in a negative way. So what are your feelings, Tony, about sustaining the passion of players who are transitioning from football as recreation and fun to football as a profession?
I can only go back from my own days, my formative days when I was playing and growing up, because it informs much of the work that I've been doing at the club, you know, since I arrived back. It's a different era of football. So in my day, you played for your school team, your town team, if you're good enough, even your house team. I had a house team at school. I played for the junior club. I played about four different types of football in a week, you know, at different levels. And then I actually had the privilege of being signed as an associated schoolboy for Manchester United, and I trained twice a week. I mean, it doesn't get any better, does it, for a 14-year-old boy? And of course, in those days, you know, I think the first time I ever heard about anybody having an agent was Dennis Lord and George Best. Who, you know, and Bobby Charlton, you heard, you know, they had agents, so you hadn't a clue who they were. Yeah. But as a schoolboy player, you know, the thought of having an agent was just, you know, you wouldn't even imagine it, you know. So it's changed a lot, you know, it's changed a lot. And of course, I think personally that it can be a distraction. You know, all the other things that are going on in the game, agents and the fact that, you know, players can be bought and sold now in a way that, you know, it didn't happen in the past. So it is a different world that we are living in, and it's a different world that young players are growing up in now. And I've got to try and adapt and think about how my experiences can connect with the young people today, you know, because I was, you know.
But how do you do that, Tone? How do you do that, Tone? When, so for instance, now when, you know, we've seen, you know, Marcus Rashford come from Fletcher Moss, you know, I live in the Manchester area and we've got some fantastic grassroots football clubs around this area. So, you know, when the Manchester United scouts turn up, or when scouts from all over the Northwest turn up and they see a player, you know, and they think, do you know what, this player's got an opportunity. When you're going to the grassroots pitches on a Sunday morning, mud everywhere, you've got to wear your wellies, not the facilities of all these illustrious training grounds we're seeing. When you go to that football pitch and see a youngster, A, what are you looking for? And B, for me, the parents as well. In modern society, modern football, parents are, listen, you know, I think they can see Manchester United scout come to watch my son or daughter, you know, lucrative, springs to mind straight away. How do you manage the expectations of the parent, and what do you look for in that young, listen, we know 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 year olds now in terms of the football progression?
Well, it's not easy. I don't think it's easy anymore. I think it's very difficult because of all the rewards now. The rewards are so high. There's a tremendous reward now about playing, getting to even a reasonable level of football now, isn't there? So everybody, you know, and everybody's looking for the next Marcus Rashford, you know, or the next, you know, whoever it is. And so it's not, and the competition is so intense now. I mean, every club has got, you know, certainly Premier League clubs have all got major recruitment department. So for example, when I was a kid, I was competing against kids from Greater Manchester, maybe the UK, you know, Northern Ireland, Scotland, possibly Wales. but now, you know, a young player in Manchester that's playing, you know, down the road, playing for a junior club or wherever, he's competing against a top player, you know, from Europe, other parts of the world. So it's not just about local football or provincial football. It's you know, the competition is so great. That's why it's so difficult. And that's what makes the job for us so much so pleasurable when we do get a local player come through. When we get a local player come through, it's even better because you know that they must be good because they're competing against the best in, you know, of other players around the world. But also the fact that they've maybe been at the club for a number of years. You know, they came from school and they've been on a journey with us as well, and we've gotten to know them. I've got to understand what their journeys have been like, the ups and the downs.
I was just going to bring Robbie in, Tony, because one of the things that strikes me about, you know, you go to Wimbledon tennis and you watch Federer practicing on the practice courts, you know, just 100 yards away from centre court, the morning of a match. And it's just incredible because the love of tennis is still there. He plays a slice, then he does a drop shot, then he does something unusual, and he laughs, and there's some... You know, Billie Jean King was interviewed, one of the great female tennis players, and she was asked, you practice tennis 4 hours a day, every day for years, did you ever get bored? She said no, because the ball never came over the net in the same way twice. Yeah. There is something, Robbie, distinctive about that. And I remember you saying to me when we did the podcast with Fred that your love of football... It stayed with you throughout your career. You went in and you still had that hunger. How do you sustain it in your youth team? Because you must have kids who turn up to training who don't want to be there, who want to go through the motions. What do you do to reignite that love?
Listen, I want players in my team to want to be there because the opportunity they can get from, you know, my experiences as a player and as a father, you know, the people I speak to, the likes of Tony, the likes of, you know, Premier League managers, grassroots, I can pass on my experiences. I'm in the belief, Matthew, that I don't force anybody to play for my football team. I don't force anybody to be involved in one of my teams. I want them to be because they love football. And if, as Tony said at the beginning, and then if I can enhance that and give them, I think a huge word is an opportunity. An opportunity, and then we know, and Tony, I'd like to ask Tony about this, the pathways they choose, whether that's themselves, whether that's the parents, but pathways are so important. What is the pathway for a, you know, for a youngster now who has a bit of potential, but maybe, you know, they will go on the wrong path? You know, I can't help them. I can help them at times, but there's so many times you can help an individual. And Tony, I'm sure you've come across... talented players who have chosen their own path.
Correct. Just going back to Matthew's comment though before about love of the game. Did you see Ronaldo's reaction to his goal last night?
Yeah, 100th for Portugal.
Or his 100th goal.
Amazing.
His reaction to his, and I was thinking to myself when I was watching it, I was thinking, wow, he's still excited. It was like as if he's just scored a goal in the park.
Yeah.
You know, in a pickup match. He was just so thrilled about it as well, and which I think emphasises the point.
But you know,
that even for a player that's reached that level of performance, you know, year in, year out, you know, week in, week out, we know how demanding that is, that he can still react in that way and still be a little boy.
I mean, Ronaldo's an interesting example. Obviously, you've been at United while he came through and then obviously left. Mm-hmm. One of the things that struck me, I interviewed Ronaldo for a couple of hours in Madrid. And he said that he was hugely influenced by, in particular, Giggs and Neville. Because you talked about them coming on Thursday nights to the Cliff to train after college, and they had an incredible work ethic. He said when he turned up, they all stayed on after conventional training to practice free kicks or their shots their accuracy. The work ethic, he said, he took it with him, and he started practicing the free kick through with the laces. And once he arrived in Madrid, he had exactly the same work ethic. That combined with the love of the game, that's got to be the perfect storm, right?
Absolutely. And it goes along with that, what I call that scarlet thread that goes through the youth department at our football club. That there's certain things, certain values that that we're expected to adhere to. And one of them, going back to, you know, Sir Matt Busby and Jimmy Murphy as assistant manager, was a work ethic. You know, talented players, you know, aren't going to be successful unless they work hard. And I think that you know, was obviously very, very evident under Sir Alex, and has always been a really important part of the club. So it's not just about talent. It's about how you manage that talent, how you use that talent, and having a, you know, a really good, strong work ethic is one of them.
But, you know, Tony, but how would you explain? So, as you've watched thousands of youth games, as I have, and when I see a talent, yeah, and you think, do you know what, they've got everything. They're intelligent, you know. Some might be quicker than others. Some might be stronger than others. Some develop different to others. Yeah. How do you distinguish between keeping somebody on the right path as a coach and somebody who may be a bit more of a handful, may be a bit more talented, yeah? Do you put more time and effort into, what I'm trying to say is, does the more talented one who a coach might think might have more of an opportunity in the future, will they get more leeway?
Really good question, that. I think it depends on the coach. It depends on what your philosophy is of developing young players. I think an interesting way to look at it is I think we're all aware of that wonderful series, The Last Dance, that's being shown at the moment, yeah, on Netflix. Brilliant. And if you look at the way that Phil Jackson manages those players, so he manages Michael Jordan in a lot different way than he did Rodman. But the fascinating thing about that series that I picked up on, and I've watched it a couple of times, it's like a coaching course to me. I think it was just amazing to watch it and to learn from it even now. But I think episode 9, where is it Steve Kerr's journey?
Yeah, fantastic. Best episode.
Which has always been under the radar. Always under the radar. Always the guy that had to work twice as hard as everybody else. Always the guy that, I think he describes himself as saying that he never got a girl.
That's right.
And I thought, you know, I think each episode is about 50 minutes. And I watched that about an hour and a half because I kept on pressing the pause and rewinding it. There was so much to be learned because most players, I think, you know, a lot of players that I've experienced in my career are like him. You know, it's not your Wayne Rooney's, your Route 1s, or your Ryan Giggs, your Route 1s, the ones that are very clearly going to be top players because they're so talented, your Michael Jordans. It's just Steve Kerr's and identifying who they are, those players that have got the resilience, they've got a wonderful work ethic, they've taken a few bounces. And I think the most moving part of that series for me was when he gets the acknowledgement from Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
And Michael Jordan says to him, you know, you made that shot, and you know, I've got, and then he says in the press conference afterwards, you know, I've got a lot of respect for him because of the way that he said, look, you need to do this for me, and he did it. And that was probably worth more than 10 MVPs to him at that particular point.
I mean,
you know, he stepped up to, I think the term that he used was he stepped up to the plate.
Yeah, I think, is it, and I mean, Kerr was the one, he's the one who lost his father, right, to a terrorist incident when he was
an absolutely incredible
episode. But the thing he's got, so just for those who haven't watched The Last Dance, you've got to watch this series. I mean, it is absolutely fantastic. But am I right in remembering that Jordan was being double marked and passed to Kerr?
That's right.
And then Kerr nailed that basket beautifully.
Yeah, but the thing about that was that it actually gave him the heads up beforehand.
That's right.
And he said, yes, I was waiting. Yeah. You know, and then it happened, and bang, you know. And he said that, you know, that you just know that it meant so much to him.
Right.
Because of, obviously, you know, his father, and the fact that Michael Jordan, probably the greatest basketball player that had ever played, he'd earned his respect. And to me, that was everything.
Robbie, I know you're going to come in, but I just wanted to ask you one thing on this, because we talked about talent, we talked about work ethic and attitude. There have been players who have been super talented at United who haven't made it. And I want to know just how frustrating it is for you to see somebody like Ravel Morrison. I think Sir Alex Ferguson called him probably the most gifted, the most naturally gifted young kid I've ever seen. When somebody like that doesn't make it,
breaks your heart. No question about it, breaks your heart. But I think the thing about that, in terms of dealing with it and managing it, is that, you know, obviously, you can, and I'm aware that he got a lot of support, immense support, not least from people like Sir Alex, but Rio Ferdinand, senior players, other people at the club, everybody went over backwards to try and get him back on the right path. And but I think it just shows you, though, that not everybody can, that's got wonderful talent and amazing talent, can get there, because there are other qualities involved, of course. You know, you have to be able to manage your life. There's other things, that, there's other distractions that are out there. You know, maybe the company that you keep when you're a young boy, you know, the habits that you get into. And so you can't win them all, is what I'm trying to say. You can't. But I think what you can do is do your best to keep them on the straight and the narrow. And I think in his case, I think certainly everybody at the football club can look in the mirror and say, we did everything that we could to make sure that he could, you know, he achieved his potential. And unfortunately, he didn't. He moved on. And but I think it just shows you that, you know, even though you've got, you may have some, you know, wonderful talent, there's a lot more to it than that, a lot more to it than that.
So what do you look for now, Tone? So as I've alluded to, when you go and watch a grassroots game, what do you look for in a young player? Not just talent, what is it, the way he conducts himself, the way he speaks to referees, the way he speaks to his parents, you know, do you find out what is he like in school? What are all the things that contribute?
Well, you have to have, in my opinion, a holistic approach. It's not just about talent. A boy can have talent, but he also has to have other qualities, a good disposition, a good temperament, you know, well-rounded, if possible. That would be, obviously, it's a development process.
This is really interesting. Say you're a parent. Mm-hmm. You're not involved in football, necessarily. You've got a child who's fascinated in playing the violin, maybe, or they want to play tennis, or they've got interested in science. If you become too regimented too early, it can take the love.
Absolutely.
What psychologists call intrinsic motivation. It can take that away. So correct. What would be your advice to parents to nurture the love without, as it were, institutionalising too much?
I hear stories about young players not going to their own birthday party, you know, not doing other things, you know, just concentrating on training and being at the club and going up and down motorways and all of that. Well, I don't think that's healthy at all. I think in the long term, it affects young players' well-being, because it takes the joy and the fun out of it anyway. And, you know, it's the love of the game that drives it. It drives everything, because that gets you through the downside. You know, I broke my leg when I was 31. You know, came up from America, broke my leg. I didn't know, never, first time in my life probably, that I hadn't been able to go and walk about or go for a run.
What was it, a football injury?
Playing in a game, yeah. And it's about sort of, you know, so what kept me going, I always think, I still love football. I still loved it. Didn't, you know, so, you know, I went another way. I didn't stay in football. I didn't get a job in football initially. I got into social work, but I coached part-time. I was always coaching part-time at different camps, Bobby Charlton soccer schools and FA courses and all of that. So I still loved the game. I wasn't expecting to come back in full-time. So I think, you know, again, you know, I answer this and say in this way that you know, the environment I grew up in as a young player was joyous. I remember the school teachers that I had, my Sunday league manager, and they're my heroes now because of the way that, you know, it wasn't, you know, they'd pull me up, Whelan, get your maths done because you can't play for me. What?
Yeah.
You know, yeah. What, sir?
One thing that we do during the podcast with all our guests, and it's these set questions. So if you don't mind, I'm going to go just to the first one now.
We haven't finished, have we? We haven't finished.
No. But we've got what we've decided to do, Robbie. Mike, the producer, has decided. I have to throw these questions in at different parts of the podcast.
Okay.
So the first one is, in your profession, what was the weakest part of your skills that you had to work the hardest to improve on?
As a coach. Oh, IT, no question.
Which is ironic, given how much problems we had setting up this Zoom call.
Anybody that knows me will know that it's IT. Not great at it at all. So that wouldn't be a surprise to anybody that knows me. IT.
Okay, well, let me... go on, Rob. Do you want to... Go on, jump in, Rob.
Yeah, I was going to ask Tony, when you talked about... Matthew, you can come in. You know, growing up in Reading, you know, going to one of the local community centres to play table tennis in. You talk about the environment, and you know, we see the likes of Messi, you know, all the players from South America, you know, the street footballers playing on such terrible surfaces. Still, you know, I'm involved in a team, and a lot of my players will be, you know, like, you know, from local communities, maybe not the greatest facilities, maybe not the greatest areas. You know, as I say, they can choose their own pathways. Are those players still, you know, I grew up in a local estate in Wrexham, little cul-de-sac, and the hunger for me was, you know, I wanna be a footballer. I would have to do everything I can to be a footballer.
How young when you had that ambition, Rob?
Well, since 4, 5, 6, 7, since I can remember. And I look at all these, you know, the street footballers, the way they play, the way they just play with this freedom, you know, playing on the concrete like I used to. And players still, you know, those players, and they fought for themselves on the street. They've got something inside them that they never want to give up. Are those players still the ones with the hunger?
I think so. I think those players can come through. Yeah, it might it might take a little bit longer. A Steve Kerr might be under the radar, but I think the secret is trying to identify who they are. That is the secret, because they're not in your face. They're not instant. You have to find out. That's why you have to make connections with young players. That's the very reason why it's a process, because you have to try to get into a mindset of a young player, know what his background is, know what makes him tick. That is key. You know, so it's not just about delivering coaching sessions. It's about trying to understand and get into a mindset to understand what works and what doesn't work for a particular young player. That's what was so remarkable about, again, that programme, The Last Dance, because he knew Jackson. He knew how to get the best out of his players. How can get the best out of Michael Jordan? Well, let him be boss.
It's interesting that, right? Because it's remarkable how Phil Jackson was willing to cede authority strategically to Jordan, because he knew that Jordan took on that leadership role brilliantly. And then with just on this, Tony.
I think the other thing as well that I feel about that particular series is how Michael Jordan used his celebrity and his authority amongst the team to get the best out of other players, but also to help them to get where they want to with that sort of. Just that will to win, that he just drove everybody with him. He got everybody on side. If you weren't, you know, I know that you're not going to be as good as me, but you're going to work at least as hard as me.
And he was tough. He was never prepared to ask people to do something that he wasn't prepared to do himself.
Matthew, this is for you and Tony from me. This is from you and Tony from me. So I'm involved in a football club right now, and I went to watch him play the other night. And there was a young player playing for the opposition. And I was standing with my mate Paul Dickoff. And he come over to us and he leant on the barrier. And he went, and this is like tier seven. And he looked at the pair of us and he said, "Can I ask you a question, please?" So he said, "Yeah." He said, "You've just seen us play. What's the difference between this and being a Premier League footballer? Why were you two Premier League footballers? And you've seen the standard here." And I said, "Yeah, very, very good. What is the difference?" And do you know what? I looked at Paul and I went, I don't know. Is it consistency? What is it from Matthew for you and for you, Tony? It's a great question.
For me, when I watch players live at different rungs of the hierarchy from Premier League downwards, the fundamental difference is skill.
Yeah.
It is truly, Robbie, you won't see this because you got to such a high level. You played Premier League for years. When I go and watch it, and I say this in all seriousness, the skill of top footballers, I think, is higher than almost any other profession in the world, because it's so globally competitive. The filtering process starts so early. You can't get into the school team. Even if you can get into the school team, you can't get into the county team or the club academy. And it's everyone in the whole world. It's a national sport in most countries of the world, football. So then you watch the guys who get to the top. And their perceptual awareness, their ability to control the ball, to keep sight of where other players are, to manoeuvre the ball up the pitch, the strategic positioning of defenders. I watch it, I've got to tell you, in a state of massive admiration. Yeah. And then you go and watch Championship football. You know, I go with my father-in-law to watch Brentford. Are they skilled? Yes. But are they close to what happens at the top of the Premier League? No, they're not. And they're close to getting into the Premier League. They almost made it last season. So for me, the fundamental thing is the multiplicity of skills that top players deploy when they're on the pitch.
So I'll ask then you that about being at Manchester United. So when you will play a Cat 2 or a Cat 3 academy, you know, where do you see the differences then in terms of the kids' progression? Because, you know, I've seen kids in other academies who I'm thinking, wow, he should be a Cat 1. Where do you see the differences?
I don't categorise young players into any category, you know, 1, 3, whatever it is. I just watch players play. And if I see talent, and I see talent at, you know, so-called, you know, category 2 or 3 clubs, I don't think it matters. I think what matters is the environment that you're in. I think that's key in terms of development. And a coach, of course, is a key part of that environment. You know, he's key. He's you know, probably the main person in it. And what sort of, you know, environment is set? You know, is it player friendly? Can players, you know, experiment, challenge themselves? So, you know, Matthew's mentioned there very eloquently about, you know, the qualities that he sees in top Premier League players. But at some point, they were practicing that
right.
in an environment that was conducive to learning.
Right.
That those young players got the space to try something out and not make a mistake. It's okay to make mistakes. So I like to talk the language of diving headers and overhead kicks and volleys. I've never asked a kid, does he want to do volleying or diving headers or shooting or heading, and he's not been excited. Well, go and have a go. Now, you try and do a diving header to start with, or you want to try and do an over a kick, it's a difficult skill, isn't it? Yeah? But if a player wants to do it, you've got to find a way to challenge him and say, okay, create the type of environment where it's okay, you're going to cock up. So maybe I'll have a go, and I'll cock up, right? And he'll say, oh, it's okay, because he's cocked up. You know, I'll have a go. And it's sort of that sort of environment that we need to create to encourage and to stimulate players and to challenge them to fulfil their potential.
I've got to ask a question at this point. So this is a slightly technical question about football. Yeah. So I'm intrigued by your response, Tony and Robbie. So I've thought a lot about this. How do you develop skill in football? So this is your expertise, Tony. Yours too, Robbie. And obviously, there's going to be a balance between these two things. But if you think on the one hand, repetition and practice. So you practice keep-me-ups, you practice running with the ball across the field, you practice shooting. You, as it were, break football down into its component parts and then practice them. Or you might even do the curver coaching. You've probably heard of this. And I love Alf. But for those who don't know what curver coaching, it's doing lots of dribbling around cones and things of that kind. There's an alternative kind of practice, which is playing games. Playing matches, or what are called game-like situations, where you're not doing any one skill. You're doing them all at the same time. You're having to defend, you're having to look up, you're having to dribble, you're having to pass. You're having to do everything at once as you would in the match. Now, the question I've got for you, what is the right balance between these two things for players as they're coming through the ranks?
Robbie?
Tony, you go, Tom.
Well, listen, all I know is when I was a young boy, I played and I played and I played and I played. I played different types of football at different levels. So when I played for the school team, it wasn't as difficult as it was when I played for the town team. If I played for my junior club, I might have a cigar out, maybe. If I certainly played with my mates, it was a different type of football. So I learnt through play. And I've thought about this thing about, you know, the difference between technique and skill. And I see technique as being, you know, being able to pass the ball, do the cover skills, do the things without any opposition there at all. But ultimately, you've got to perform those techniques into a game.
Right.
So if you can pass the ball 30 yards, bend it, you know, curve it, head the ball, control it on your chest, you've got to be able to do it in a match. Yeah?
And it's got to connect with a teammate.
And it's got to connect with a teammate. So you've got to, and you talked about vision, peripheral vision. You can only develop that in a game.
That's
in a game
right.
situation.
Yeah, totally agree.
So in other words, for me, you know, and I'm not saying that I'm right, but from my experience playing matches, and you do need the isolated technical sessions. I've done them. You do need them, right? But that is to develop the technique. The skill of the game is transferring the technique into a match situation with everything else that's going on at a high level. So be able to pick out the flight of the ball, take it on your chest, get your body in the right position, see where the goalkeeper is, see where the goal is, see where opposition is sliding in, see where your teammates are. Yeah. I mean, Robbie, before the podcast, we were talking about the great Pelé, weren't we? Yeah. And the famous goal, the famous fourth goal in the 1970 World Cup final. And we were talking about how he didn't even look, but you knew that Carlos Alberto, the captain, was streaming down on the right-hand side.
Yeah?
Yeah? I think we all know it, don't we?
Yeah.
That particular clip. Fantastic. But Pelé's peripheral vision is in a match. The technique's perfect. The control is weighted. He's played a beautiful pass, just beautifully weighted and timed. Now, it's a match situation. It's not the practice ground. But obviously, he's practiced outside of the game. But crucially, to get to that level, you've got to be able to execute in a match. And that's, I think, the art of coaching, is to transfer skills into a match.
You know, the one, Tone, and Matthew, now, is when people say, you know, they want it here and now. If their son or daughter signs professionally, you know, for a football club, it's about now. It's a journey, Tony, isn't it? There's, as I say, kids will develop at different times. Like in my side now, they're not academies. They've been at academies, and for one reason or another, at an early age, 12, 13, 14, they've been told they're not quite right for that football club then. But then it's about the resilience, the reaction, and they've still got an opportunity, haven't they? Because some might develop later when they're 17, 18. So the dream can always be alive, can't it?
Wally, let me tell you, I was a late developer. All right, when I signed for United at 15, and I always felt I had an inferiority complex because I hadn't played for Lancashire boys or England boys. That was sort of the level then. England boys was like, in those days. So you had the sort of what they call the pyramid system, school team, town team, county team, England boys. And I'd only played for my local Stretford boys, or what would be called Trafford boys now. But everybody that had signed, apart from a lad called Brian Greenough, sadly deceased, former player, and a lad called Tony Young, we're the only players that the club had signed as apprentices that year who weren't internationals. And I felt it was a bit of a hang-up to me at that particular time. But by the time I was 17, when I was 17 years of age, I went on the first team tour to Bermuda, Canada and the United States in 1970. So in two years, I'd left them behind. You know, so, you know, and that informs a lot of my work that I do now. You know, most of the players that come through, in my opinion, in my experience, are late developers. The slow burners. They're not the ones that are right in your face. The ones that are right in your face, everybody can spot them. Mm. All the agents are looking for them, Matthew, by the way. Mm. Right? But it's those other ones. It's the slow burners, the ones that the growth's not quite ready yet. You know, they've got a wonderful spirit about them. And they just need a bit of nurturing. They need a bit of support. They need a bit of love. They need you to be patient.
Tony, let me jump in. Sorry, but I'm getting on the WhatsApp chat for Mike, the producer. You've got to bring in the second question, the second set question. So this is, what is the one thing you haven't got any talent in but wish you had?
Oh, languages.
Really?
Languages, yeah. I think I miss my way. I'd love to learn Latin. I'd love to learn Spanish. My daughter lives in Spain at the moment, and I've got two grandchildren that are Spanish, or one's French, but the other one's Spanish. Yes, a language, no question about it, a language.
I'll tell you what, I'm going to come in, and I know listeners are going to hate my response to this, because I've always thought, if you learn a new language, I know you get to understand the culture of the language, the nation of that language, much better and a lot of nuance. But the thing is, if you learn the word for red in French, which is rouge, you're just learning a phonetic, an arbitrary phonetic for a concept you already understand. So I've never got the infatuation with languages.
Well, I'm interested in ancient history, particularly Roman history.
You're interested in history?
Ancient history in particular. Yeah. But I know, because I read you know, some of the classical works in translation. And I know that I'm missing out so much because I don't have the language.
Talking history, I wanted to shift it on to the Busby Babes.
Correct.
Because in a funny kind of a way, Tony,
we've come a long way from Rome to Manchester now, haven't we?
Weren't they flying back from Turin? Now, where were they flying back from?
They were flying back from Belgrade.
From Belgrade, and then they stopped off in Munich.
They stopped off
and they're slush on the runway. Yeah. And this extraordinary generation, of young, wonderful players with whom the whole nation had fallen in love. Many of them lost their lives on that day. Now, you've done your master's dissertation on the Busby Babes. I'd love to hear what you've learned, and if you can connect it to people listening, what's of relevance to them?
Well, I think just to go backwards to let you know how it started, I think that's important. I'd completed an open university degree, you know, sort of in my 30s, took me about 8 years. But at that particular time, I don't know whether it's changed, but you didn't have an opportunity to do a dissertation with the OU, so you graduated. So I graduated without actually having done a thesis. And I always felt that I hadn't quite completed my university experience. So I started looking around for a course that I could take, that I could do a more extended piece of work. And I found one at Manchester Metropolitan University, MMU, in a department of interdisciplinary studies. The campus was then at Alsager. I think, Robbie, you played at Crewe, didn't you? So where Alsager is. They had a campus there, and they allowed you to do a piece of research. I think it was something like 30,000 words on a topic of your interest. And I got a really wonderful supervisor called Dr. Ken Parsons, and I picked up the idea really from Nobby Stiles, who a wonderful, you know, player from the club and a World Cup winner. Who's not very well. But when we were coaching, we'd sit in the bath at the Cliff, you know, the coach's room there, Robbie. We'd sit in the bath chatting away, and Nobby would tell me stories about, he loved Eddie Coleman, for example. He'd be telling stories about Eddie Coleman and different players that he remembered when he was a young player. And I got fascinated by it. I'm thinking that'd be great to do some research on that. And I'd read a few books about the Busby Babes, but I hadn't really... it was always about afterwards, after they'd sort of got in the first team, you know, when they were sort of superstars at that time. So I got interested in their development prior to them being professionals, prior to their fame. And so I approached the university and they said, yeah, that looks a good topic. It'll probably fall under, we've got somebody who's interested in young people, a researcher here that can supervise you. So basically I spent 2 years having a ball, literally interviewing some former players. Bill Foulkes, who was obviously a sort of Munich survivor, I interviewed him. I interviewed Wilf McGuinness.
Yep.
And basically, I was trying to find out what happened. So when they left school at 15, because in those days, Matthew, like now you can sign for a club when you're nine into an academy. In those days, and this is important, you couldn't sign for a club until you'd left school. Crucial, this. So Bobby Charlton, wonderful footballer, World Cup winner, European Cup winner, right? He played, his development was schools football. Town team, county team, England boys, right? Signs for United, right? Gets a job, right? Goes into accommodation, gets a job, goes to Stretford Grammar School. Plays for Stretford Grammar School in the morning, plays for the club in the afternoon. Phew, not going to work that. So he jacks the grammar school. Gets coached twice a week at the Cliff, two nights a week, Jimmy Murphy, training them at the Cliff, right? So I got to find out the process of recruitment, what the recruitment team was like. Read a lot about a famous scout called Joe Armstrong, who scouted Bobby Charlton, famous scout. What the recruitment was like, different, you know, they had recruitment people in Ireland, in Scotland. Didn't have many scouts, but they had a really efficient system. I mean, Joe Armstrong, for example, worked for the GPO, which was then, you know, obviously communication, so we could communicate because he worked for them.
And what does GPO stand for?
I can't remember.
The General Post Office.
And so I learned about what the training was like at the Cliff back in the early 50s. They went on, you know, what the A team was. Did you play in the A and B teams, Robbie?
Yeah, I played the
right.
A and B teams.
What they used to play in what they call the Lancashire League, the A team and the B teams, they'd play around. And I found out about when they first went to Europe. They went to Europe in 1954 for the Blue Stars tournament, which they won, right? So you can imagine, they won the Youth Cup for 5 years on the bounce.
Wow.
5 years on the bounce, right? So what I'm saying is, so they go to Switzerland. They go for the first time, right? The youth team, first time that a Man United team had been in Europe, right? Who's on the plane with them? Sir Matt, you know, Matt Busby, Jimmy Murphy, all the senior staff, making a statement about youth. A massive statement about that. So then not long afterwards, right, they enter the European Cup. Right? So you're thinking to yourself, wow, you know, what Busby had seen in Europe playing against Italians, playing against, they'd seen it before, so it wasn't a surprise. So people think, oh, when they went into Europe, it's the first time. No, they'd been there as young kids. Yeah. They'd been there at 16 and 17, playing in the Blue Stars. I think they won it the first year, and then I think maybe the second year, and then they got, I think one of the teams, you know, some team got really, some Italians played, you know, Catenaccio defence and all of that. And Bobby Charlton always says, well, you know, we didn't know what it is. You know, we didn't know, they were all defending. So I learnt loads about that particular era.
Did you ever meet Busby himself, Tony?
He was my first manager. What a privilege that was.
Busby was.
I signed for United in 1968. So they won the European Cup in the May. I started my apprenticeship on July the 27th, I think it was, of 1968. So I walk into the Cliff training ground, which you've been to, and I'm walking into those three superstars, Best, Law Charlton, and Sir Matt Busby's the manager.
And what sort of interaction did you have with them? As I said
to you before, it was a very intimate place in those days, because you, as a young player, you find yourself in the canteen sitting down with those wonderful players, having your meal. When I went on the first team tour at 17, I've gone with six or seven players that had won the European Cup. Only 2 years later, Johnny Aston, Paddy Crerand.
I've got to tell you, how bad an interviewer am I? I mean, I should have been asking you about this at the beginning. What was the social interaction like between Law, Best, and Charlton? Did they get on? Did they sit on different tables? They seem to be.
No, they're fine. They were fine. Look, I'm a 17-year-old boy. Well, we've got the benefit of hindsight now because I'm, you know, I'm 35 or something. but I just remember that it was a wonderful. You could just imagine a young boy at 16, 17, walking around in, you know, the Cliff, and bumping into them, and even in some of the practices, getting involved and playing and practicing with them. I mean, I had the privilege to play with George Best in Fort Lauderdale.
No way.
Later on, yeah. And it was wonderful. And Gordon Banks, by the way.
Wow.
And Gerd Muller.
No way.
Yeah, I think at the same time.
And he's got to be.
But just going back to those three players, what I remember about them as a young boy, as a young apprentice or a young professional, was that they treated you well. I mean, George would bring his old, his, you know, what they call hipsters and fancy shirts and give them away because, you know, for the lads. Everybody wanted to get in Dennis Law's car to get a lift to Old Trafford because he had a wonderful Jag, you know. Nobby Styles, he wasn't sure whether he could see because he wore contact lenses. So you think, well, go with Nobby. You've got a chance that you won't get to Old Trafford to do your chores. But that's what it was like. So you'd be queuing up saying, I hope I'm getting Dennis's car, or I hope I get a lift off Bobby, or, you know. And that's what it was like. You can't imagine that happening now, could you?
And I think that must frustrate you because you're speaking so eloquently, so emotionally, so well about your experiences as a 17-year-old with the first team. And it must frustrate you now, Tony, as it frustrates me, when I know what we went through, as you've alluded to in this podcast, cleaning toilets, cleaning boots, doing jobs. And now when we're seeing youngsters who haven't listen, I believe anybody who's in the academy system at an early age has achieved amazing things.
Absolutely.
They've done amazingly well to get to the academy to start with. And that's just the beginning. But then when we're seeing youngsters now who are having everything, you know, because of the wealth in the game now, I think that really frustrates me when they haven't really kicked on from being that, you know, that schoolboy, that apprentice to, you know, that first team player, and all the, you know, the wealth comes to them quickly now.
But Robbie, it's not their fault.
No, it's not.
It's not their fault. It's the system that we're in, right? And I think one of the challenges for us as coaches, for me as a coach and the staff, is to make sure that those young players stay grounded, that it's still important, that those values that I grew up with all those years ago, that I still adhere to, are passed on, and that they share them, passing on and saying, well, all right, you know, even though there's this and this and this and this, you know, I mean, I suppose, that, you know, we've mentioned it already, I've mentioned it myself, as being one of my weaknesses. One of the biggest distractions at the moment, in my opinion, is unquestionably social media. Because kids always want to be on their phones.
Yep.
You know, it's not my world. It's not my world. But I have a responsibility as a coach. If I want to connect with young people, that I've got to understand that that's their world. I might not understand it, but I've got to actually relate to them and connect with them. You know, so they'll take the mickey out of me. They'll show me their phones and I'll have a look. Yep. I've got to show that I'm engaged and allow them to take the mickey out of me because I don't understand it. Because it's a way of connecting.
Yeah.
You know, it's a way of connecting. And that's so important because it's not just about... You know, communication is not just about the coaching, what happens on the grass. And we've all got our coaching licenses and we've all got our badges. But for me, you've got the most important thing is to know when you need the coaching badge and when you don't. And with young players, most of the time, you don't need the coaching badge. Leave it at home, leave it in your drawer and pull it out for, you know, when you're looking for a coaching job.
Now we're taking a break to tell you about this.
We're trying to be more intentional with our time. Do more to stretch our brains. That means less mindless scrolling, more learning. With the Great Courses Plus, you have unlimited access to thousands of video and audio courses on hundreds of fascinating topics. Learn a new language, discover what Einstein got wrong, even gain valuable insights into your own public persona. There really is something for everyone. The courses are taught by the best professors and top experts in their fields.
I'd recommend the Boosting Your Emotional Intelligence course. For young footballers, having so many pressures in the modern game, learning how to keep your emotions in check and understand the impact that they have is vital to achieving success.
It's high quality content, reliable, fact-based information you can trust. Plus, with the Great Courses Plus app, you're free to watch, listen and learn on any device at any time. Get started with a free month of unlimited access. Just visit our special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/talent. That's a whole month to learn anything. Remember, thegreatcoursesplus.com/talent.
Tony, I want to ask you three rapid-fire questions. The first one, I've got to ask it because we had a big debate, the newspaper that I write for, who was the best player out of Best, Charlton and Law. And I've got to tell you, the older readers got so angry. Some were saying definitely Best, then Charlton. No, but Law was the best all-round player. Who was the best of those three?
Well, I don't think you could say the best.
Come on. If you had to pick one.
If I had to pick one, you're pinning me down.
I'm pinning you down.
Dennis Law.
Wow, really? He was that good.
I think he was so good, but he was just dynamic. I just remember his whole presence on the field, the way he strutted out, his arrogance, his flamboyancy, his electricity. Okay. Well, of course, you know, I'm looking at Dennis Law when I'm, you know, 12, 13. So it's an impression. I remember being at a match at Old Trafford and seeing him doing a diving header on the far post. You know, like, you just want to, it just idolised him.
Okay, I've got to ask you this one too. Okay, so if you also could include... You got to include then Cantona, Ronaldo, Giggs.
Cantona
Robbie.
Was wonderful. Cantona.
What a player! I love Cantona.
You know that strut, that arrogant strut, and the delicacy of touch for such a big man, and the way he just strode the stage. He was magnificent.
Skulls,
wonderful, but in different ways. You know, his first touch, as Robbie will know, his first touch, his vision.
Yeah.
You know, he'd get on the half turn, always knew what was behind him. You know, going back, you don't get that from isolated practice. You get that from playing in games. I think that was one of Eric Harrison's big, one of the greatest talents that you'll know this, Robbie, yourself, but you played a lot of games, didn't you?
Yeah, loads of games. Loads
played
of games.
Lots of games. And he'd pull you up in the games and correct you and all of that. So, you know, those guys were supported because of that. You know, they're helped because of Eric's approach to coaching.
Who would you pick out, Robbie?
Ever?
Yeah.
Well, I would say I'm harsh Scholesy, because I grew up with him. And, you know, as Tony's alluded to already, he was they had to be patient with him because he was small. Yeah. He had asthma. He wasn't in the youth team.
That's right.
I think, you know, where now...
He was Steve Kerr.
Yeah, where now, Tony,
Steve Kerr.
If you've got a player like that, and what parents can't get into their minds is if their son plays down because they might not be up to the physical demands, because they might be a late developer, because their growth, they might be on a growth spurt, then what parents can't compute is, well, that's a punishment. They mustn't be doing well. But it's not tone, is it? It's not like that. It's what's best for that particular child or that particular stage of their development.
Let me answer that question or put it another way, right? So my daughter, she fell in love with dance. And I saw her love of dance in my love of football. Loved it. And from an early age, probably 6, 7, 8, she was dancing, doing ballet, tap, modern, taking her to a dance school. And she did that for several years. And my job, my task, and my wife's task, in our opinion, was to take her there and bring her back. Pay out for the shoes, pay out for the different things that they needed, go and see a show. But once she arrived at the dance school, none of my business. What I used to do, I look for, sat in the car, you probably don't yourself, when she came out of that studio, what is she looking like? Does she have a glint in her eye? Is she smiling? That was all I ever was interested in. She used to talk to me about the technical terms for the dancing, this and that and the other, and be in the car with her mates. And, so in other words, they will do it because they want to do it. Now, eventually, later on, she became a professional dancer. Nothing to do with me whatsoever in terms of input. No idea about dance and the movements, anything like that, right? What my job was, what my role was to get her to the dance school and get her home and pay the fees.
Yeah. Let me ask you, I've got to ask you, how proud are you when people like Rashford and Greenwood make the England team?
Well, you can imagine it's not just about me. It's about the people, you know, in the academy that have helped him on his journey. Not just coaches. See, people think it's all about coaches. A lot of people think it's all about coaches. But to get a player through to achieve at that sort of level, it involves a lot of people along the way. You know, people in education, you know, people in the office that have helped them get flights, that have helped them to do things, you know, with their letter writing or IT skills, people that drive them around, you know, sports science people, you know, the doctors, you know, a lot of people. So everybody shares in it. It's a wonderful thing. One thing I didn't mention to you with regard to the Busby Babes episode, right? When I completed my thesis, I handed it out. So one or two people that knew I was doing the thesis wanted to read it. So I gave it to a few people. And a guy called Cliff Butler, who was then the curator of the museum, said, why don't you get it published? And I thought, well, how do I do that? And he helped me and supported me and went to a few people and, you know, they were interested. But anyway, in the end, a publisher from Manchester called Empire Publishing published it. So it is out there, 2005.
So you can get it on Amazon?
Well, yeah, I think you can get it on Amazon.
Okay, well, look, we'll make sure Robbie and I tweet the link for those people listening to the
podcast. So it's out there.
Wonderful. Yeah. Now, just last question then. What is the one thing... Have I asked this already? No, this is the last one. What is the best piece of advice anyone has ever given you?
Get on to you. Okay. Probably get back on the horse when you fall off it.
Love it. Love it. Resilience. And one that I would like to ask, because it ties in Robbie, what did he have that got him into the youth team of 92?
What did who have?
Robbie.
He was Welsh. Well, Robbie was always...
Sorry, Albert.
Wanted a bit of international flavour in the youth team.
I think you've hit the nail on the head that there are more Robbie Savages that in this footballing world than Ronaldo's, Ryan Giggs's. Somebody like me who's had to work hard. Somebody to me who's enhanced his talent by hours of practice.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yep.
And I think. You know, that's what drove me into that youth team tone. And as you said in this podcast so well, that there are more, listen, even less me's, because to play 350 Premier League games is an unbelievable achievement.
Hey, I think, can I just say this as well? Can I just say this before you finish? I think one of the things that I think particularly parents sometimes don't understand, and And I think that's because of the way things are in society. Maybe people don't tell them enough how hard it is to become a professional footballer. So to become a professional footballer at any level, it's not something of the percentage of society, right? So just that's the baseline. So you want to play in the Premier League, that's another level,
yeah,
right, of difficulty, right? I think you alluded to it before, didn't you, Matthew? Yeah. And then you want to play, you play for England, that's another level. So you play for a club like Manchester United or Liverpool, you know, you're expected to be able to play in the Champions League, aren't you? So you want to play, so to play regularly in the Champions League is another level. So it's so hard. It's so, so hard. And that's why it's so important for us as coaches, in my opinion, but to protect childhood, because the attrition rate is so high. Mm. It's so high. So if you're relying on football and becoming a professional footballer, you know, your chances are, you know, they're not great, are they? In general terms, right? So you've got to have something else. You have to have another identity. You know, you have to have, you know, a life. You have to live as normal a life as possible, even though you're trying to achieve, you know, your ambitions and your dreams. And I would not want to discourage anybody from being a footballer, because it was wonderful to me. I've travelled the world. I've played with some wonderful people, met some wonderful people, people that I'm still in touch with now from that I played in the States. I wouldn't want to deprive anybody of that. But I think the key thing for parents is to, you know, enjoy the ride. Get on the train, look at the views, try and get to hope that your son or your daughter gets to as many stops as possible, but don't expect to get to the terminus at the end. And if you get there, wow. Wow.
I think that's just a wonderful way to finish. There's a great quote. Was it, I'm trying to think of the quote. There's a wonderful novel. To travel is a more beautiful thing than to arrive. And if you enjoy the journey, hit the destination too, it's the jackpot.
And the thing is, and I remember it from my daughter's dancing career, right? My wife and I used to enjoy the journey.
Yeah.
We used to enjoy going to London. We used to enjoy going to the shows in Manchester. We used to enjoy picking the kids up, dropping them off, picking them up, doing this and doing that. Because we were spending that much time doing it, but there was no stress. I mean, it was zero stress.
Tony Whelan, it's just a fantastic way to end. You're an inspirational person. I can't believe we have never connected before. I hope we will remain in contact, because I've so much enjoyed the conversation. Roberto, as ever, great to connect with you too. Please remember, for people listening, to rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Do spread the word. We've enjoyed this. Hope you have too. We'll be back with another great guest for our Talent Takes Practice podcast. But for now, from all of us, goodbye.